The Canadian Anti-Apartheid Oral Histories Project was produced in association with the 3rd Annual Institute of African Studies Conference and FESHRIFT in honor of Linda Freeman, Solidarity and Shifting Patterns of Hegemony in Southern Africa, Historical and Contemporary Perspectives, which was held on March 1st and 2nd, 2018, at Carleton University. This Oral Histories Project consists of interviews with participants of the conference, including activists, aid workers, diplomats, and politicians, who volunteered to discuss their personal experiences as part of the anti-apartheid movement in Canada. The interviews were conducted by Susan Bazilli, PhD student at the University of British Columbia, and by myself, Michael Buchert, a PhD student at Carleton University. In this interview, the Honorable Walter McLean sat down with Susan Bazilli to talk about his experiences advocating for action on South Africa as a cabinet minister in the Mulroney government. This was recorded on February 28, 2018, at Carleton University.
Okay, Walter, just tell me a little bit about your early life history and how it was that you and Barbara first ended up in Africa.
The early African interest, I guess, came out of two things. Barbara was active in World University Service at UBC with a number of international students, but a number from Africa in the late 50s. I was at the University of Toronto, and the African Student Foundation was bringing a lot of African as well as Caribbean students.
How did you and Barbara meet then, if you were in Toronto?
At a World University Service meeting in Montreal, and we met.
What year was that?
That would have been 1959. So, 1960, I was president of the Student Council, and I found, amongst other things, this is the Diefenbaker era, but I found petitions we were signing against anti-apartheid, asking the Canadian government to be taking a stand. And obviously the African students that were coming at this point, regardless of where they came from in Africa, this was an issue. When I finished at Knox College U of T and finished being president, I had a year Edinburgh, but I was also asked to represent the Canadian Union of Students, NIFCUS as it was called, to the Scottish Union and the British Union, went to their meetings, and the whole issue of Africa and race was very much on their boundary. When I came back to Canada, I went to report to the NIFCUS annual meeting at Queen's, the annual meeting of the Students of Canada, and I ended up being elected president with the support of UBC and Laval presidents and others on a campaign that I, if president, wanted the Union of Students to campaign for the concept of 2 years of international service under what became CUSO. And at that point, Bill McQuinney and others had been in Ceylon, others had been in the Caribbean, and there were several units out there. Louis Perenbaum was at UNESCO, and he did some anchoring, and we started to pull together. And I went on the road in my full-time job as president, 1961-62, across the country, talking about the concept of overseas service, not exclusively in Africa, but principally in Africa because of the African Student Foundation and the needs in so many countries where teachers with grade 10 or grade 11 were teaching and they needed to come finish education, get a basic degree. And we could send people without formal educational training who had university degrees in Canada, giving them eventually, we started at first with almost no training. Then we started giving them a short course in training techniques and orientation. So went across the country, recruited nearly 40, ready to go. Well, we had no structure. We had no transport, no budget. My boss, Reverend Ted Johnson, who was a great international church statesman, was really pleased with the concept of CUSO, and there were so many young people that he had no placing in the traditional old-style missionary places. You could get one or two, but not many. So he offered a position jointly with the Church of Scotland and the Presbyterian Church of Nigeria for me to do student work and New City work, but principally to try and get as much support for field work across Nigeria, where they were, and in Ghana, where the Church of Scotland and the Canadian Church had linkages. This meant that I had a base to travel from. Meantime, we started to get some structure in Ottawa, and Bill McQuinney became the executive director, and we began to get a little budget. My friend Duncan Edmonds, who had been on the staff of Pearson and who had brought me or been instrumental in bringing me home to co-direct with him the Miles for Millions, or the Canadian Centennial International Program, he helped in the earlier stage when he was on Mr. Martin's staff as foreign minister to get use of the Canadian aircraft so that we could fly people out to parts of Africa on training missions until the airlines began to shut it down. Meantime, we started to get negotiations with what was then the External Aid Office, then pre-CEDA, and began to get some financial support. So those years I was there, went for two, stayed for five, had midway through a sabbatical, which allowed Barbara and I to go and see what was going on. We had just begun some contacts in Uganda and in Tanzania. Nobody in Kenya, and I did some conversations with the Kenya government about Canadians, toured parts of Uganda with, I can picture, but anyway, we had a volunteer there who was acting as coordinator.
But you didn't go to South Africa during those years.
Didn't in that. But during the years in Nigeria, and this was, we got sideswiped a little by the Biafra or the Nigerian Civil War, an event that caught every Nigerians and every African's experience was the Rivona trials and the sentencing of Nelson Mandela. And the sense was the same as when Kennedy died. The Americans have lost a president. We lost a leader, and it registered with me for all time that the symbolism of the fight against racism, even though in West Africa race, because of the climate, there wasn't a big settler population, but they were nonetheless empathetic to the whole racial issue and the need to deal with it. They also had, of course, tribal and North-South Islamic Christian animist issues. So those sort of set in motion an understanding that this anti-apartheid movement was not just a South African issue and whites. This was a continental issue, or at least sub-Saharan continental issue. And in my later time, as I went and visited a large portion of the governments of sub-Saharan Africa on behalf of the Canadian government, it was quite apparent that this was a resonating place and that the position that the Canadian government was taking had a lot of credence. And later on led, of course, to part of my work at the UN. We led to our election to the Security Council and the articulate part of Stephen Lewis picking up what Prime Minister Mulroney was trying to do over against sizable opposition.
Okay, so you're getting ahead of yourself. You've mm-hmm. referenced the work you did with the Canadian government. So you came back from Nigeria, you and Barbara came back from Nigeria, and then how did you end up becoming elected to the Canadian Parliament?
Well, after the centennial, there was a prospect of what became IDRC. However, Mr. Pearson stepped down, and there was an interregnum before Trudeau Sr. came in, and the whole idea of IDRC disappeared, and Edmonds went off to Winnipeg, and We had had such successful walks across the country that they had set up the Manitoba Association for World Development. I went out to direct it. Then I got seconded to direct the Manitoba Centennial because they wanted somebody with some centennial experience. And we've just been dealing with John Fisher and the national, and Bobby Jimby and all of the national mobilization. So when that finished, and I thought I would stay with a very young family, twins born and in Manitoba, which was a very family-oriented place, they change of government, Walter Weir, who was the premier, called an election, forgot to fight it, and the NDP won under Ed Schreyer. So I helped them through that centennial, wrote Ed's first speeches a year before he was inducted, and we were doing community work on international development, but we were also trying to engage communities to celebrate locally, but also think globally, and Manitobans are pretty good at that. In any event, when that ended, the Manitoba Centennial, I had a brief, I had an invitation to direct the Prince Edward Island one for 73. I went down, helped them organize, but I realized that that was not something. And I was speaking about African issues generally in Guelph, at the University of Guelph, where my uncle, Professor Gordon Townsend, was a professor of apiculture dealing with African beekeepers. And we were, anyway, he invited people from Knox Church, which is beside the University of Waterloo, to come over and meet me. And they wouldn't take no. Had a very young family housing, and so settled in for 10 years as minister there. But it was involved with the church's international programs and with the Canadian Council of Churches. Chaired the International Affairs Committee for the Canadian Council of Churches in the mid-70s. There, Ted Scott and others were raising the issue, and the United Church, Garth Legge, and I think I
was Renata Pratt there.
Well, I knew Renata on the edge, and I remember meeting Cran in Dar es Salaam during visits to Tanzania and there. And so there were during that visit, which I described earlier, going to East Africa, went on to India and Malaysia and saw CUSO trying to start in India. It wasn't really a fit. We withdrew from there. We had some in Ceylon. Anyway, I had a look at CUSO, came home, and that led to coming back for 2 years, the Biafra War, came back to the Canadian Centennial. So that was the 5 years there, a year and a half in Ottawa, three years in Winnipeg. Then I was invited to come to Waterloo, which proved to be a very happy choice.
And you've been there now how many years?
I've been there since since 1971. So... And in the community, involved with the Rotary and their international programs, involved with the churches, and involved with the old 10 Days for World Development. And we had a number of centers or a number of multicultural centers and so on, which I was a part of. And I ran for city council, was twice elected, and came a new riding in 1979. Waterloo had been part of Cambridge. The area was growing from two ridings. It now has five, but it was two to three. And they were forming a new Waterloo riding, which included three rural townships to the north. I was known Joe Clark and Brian Mulroney in student politics. Joe was president of the Canadian University Press when I was president of the National Union of Students, or Canadian Union of Students. And he had been elected party. I knew him, and Mulroney had been contesting as early as 76. So I knew them from university days, and I had been in touch with them, and was helping Clark to find some candidates. I thought after 25 years of one-party rule, it was time for something else. I was an unlikely candidate for a conservative party, but I'd never been really involved partisanly. I'd been dealing with municipal and student politics and the universities of Canada, and I had a pretty good national vision. I grew up in Victoria, the West Coast, and with UBC and I, U of T, so I had those experiences of the universities, of traveling the country and so on. So
Joe asked you to run?
No, Joe asked me to help find some candidates in five ridings. And I went looking for people who might share generally incentive and compassion and blend the best of progressive conservative ideas. And had some luck in a couple of those, including the new Waterloo riding, which had a candidate in place. He was a lawyer, and his law practice had difficulties. He withdrew on the eve of the election, and I was left asking the regional chair, the mayor of Waterloo, and others that were going to ride. Suddenly, I have a delegation come to me saying, and I'm very happy with a very young family. And so I said to them, I don't think that with my interests, a very great fit. They said, you underestimate our area. We have peacekeeping or peacemaking initiatives of the Mennonite community in the University Conrad Grebel. We have a long tradition of international perspective, and we have on human rights issues and so on. So a lot of people from the community, the church, Rotary, and others set about, and so I won. The new riding.
And what did Barbara think about that?
Well, Barbara was new. We had been doing all these things together, so she knew the players, she knew Joe Clark, and so we knew. She knew what we were getting into because we had looked at the political structures there, and I had contact with Bill Davis and so on, who I thought was doing a balanced sort of job. So
they really got two for one when they got the two of you.
Yeah, they did indeed, because she had been in some ways far more active in the nuts and bolts of how campaigns are run than all of this when I was an alderman or anything else. And she pulled in more than her weight, as did the boys as they grew, all four of them. So it was not as if you were doing something. Anyway, we won. And we won, I think, in the spring, May or June. And I had I wasn't certain I was going to win. I had to ask the leaders of the church, if I lose, can you ever hear me preach, some of them were NDP, some were liberals, some were conservatives. They laughed and said, we know you, and actually encouraged me to do this, said that they thought it would be a legitimate kind of ministry. Anyway, that we won when the three rural townships, plus the city of Waterloo and a little of Kitchener, so it was a sizable area. I got to Ottawa in September. Finally, they found an office after all these years of Liberal majority. It's transition. Physically was taking a time. Found a few staff. The next thing I knew, I had one or two assignments. Ron Atkey, who was the immigration minister, sent me and he sent David Kilgore to Asia about the vote people. I went to Hong Kong and Macau, try to energize or at least work with the political staff to increase the people coming and working on sponsorships with the churches. You remember that history. So I got started on that. I became a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee briefly. Next thing I knew, the budget night, I flew back with Joe Clark on a plane out of Toronto for a vote, which I don't think He expected to it would be straightforward, and of course, next thing you knew, the vote came, and that was the end, and we were into an election. And
so, what year was that?
That was that was the defeat was in the end of 79. The election was early 80, midwinter, and I was forecast to lose. The papers had my defeat, the Waterloo record. Students at the university, Wilfrid Laurier, many of them came out in the old Burma shave, putting up signs and moving around from place to place, got energized, and a whole range. So I lost 5,500 votes, and won by 100, had a recount. The party lost Guelph, and they lost Kitchener. I stayed on, and from there on, with Barbara's help, determined that if I was going to be there, then I would have to make sure that that my profile stayed high, and I was in touch with people and I'd hardly got started. So the opposition years then were dealing with a lot of work on the nuclear issue. We were in the Cold War, mutual assured destruction, and I spent a lot of time organizing with Doug Roach. We were both the conservatives, but with the help of Trudeau's office and Tom Axworthy and others who were helping orchestrate us build an international coalition of socialists and conservatives, or left and right, to go and confront the superpowers to deal with Reagan and Gorbachev. So those were years which there was a lot of sympathy in Waterloo from the pacifist elements and Mennonite community on arms and arms reduction, as there is to this day through Project Plowshares and others.
So, and what were you doing on the anti-apartheid front during those opposition
years? At those years, not a great deal. I mean, it was there. I was on the Foreign Affairs Committee. We were beginning to get into the sanctions pushback. Quite frankly, it wasn't really high on the agenda of the Liberal Party.
And what about what was civil society doing at that time?
Well, civil society was starting to organize. I mean, the Canadian Council of Churches and the Committee on Corporate Social Responsibility, they were beginning to be active. But a lot more we were playing, or not playing, but we were under pressure from civil society on the nuclear issue to do something. And when you get the delegations in your office saying, do something, we elected you Member of Parliament, you suddenly are responding. In that period, there wasn't a lot of thing. And I was shadow cabinet for the status of women. Now, the women's movement, as I was in touch with them, and I went to the first conference in Copenhagen for 2 weeks or something, and the certainly on the women's issue, race and African issues were surfacing very much. So, and as when I became Secretary of State, but being Shadow Secretary of State, dealing with human rights, dealing with multiculturalism, dealing with those issues, certainly the race issue was always there, and to a certain extent the First Nations, because the funding of them on racial issues. So that took us through the leadership issue. And while Joe Clark and I have been friends and kind of repaired somewhat, it became apparent to me that the pressure inside the Conservative Party was not going to be such that he was going to be able to chart a very moderate thing. The Horners, the people out of the West, were very dogmatic, and the tension in the party from that those elements that later became the Reform Party, but out of the Republican Right, and we were getting into the period of Reagan and Thatcher, and that the touch points for many of those. So that when Clark decided to call the leadership, I had discussions, or I had been in touch with Mulroney. I knew him when he, in Montreal when he ran the Canadian. Invited me as president of students to the Laval Conference on Canadian Affairs, which the early makeup of Canada, he and Michael Mean and Michelle Cogger and others who were Anglophones at Laval but understood Quebec. And I could see that he was going to be able to make some inroads in Quebec. And I didn't come to Parliament just for the experience. I thought, if I'm there, I would like to be on the government side. And so I supported Mulroney. He had, as he says in his own book, he had a lot of support on the right. He needed some people on the left. I also knew of his admiration for Diefenbaker, and Diefenbaker's, whether it's accurate or not, but his role in South Africa had caught Mulroney's attention. And the result was that with...
So before he became leader, he already was aware of the South African issue?
Very much so. Yeah, he was. And so when he became leader, he had an enormous pressure. The events around 85 and 86 on the sanctions issues began to be heavily looked at. A lot of the pressure from the business community, and he was out of it, and others. And so
that was 85 and 86 were the two states of emergency.
Emergencies. Now, during those years, I was Secretary of State of Canada, so I was dealing with women's issues, and I was also minister responsible for the status of women and the status of the disabled. And that, so from the first period, I was working on the human rights issues. And for example, when continuing interest, when Archbishop Desmond Tutu came, because of he was a member of the ANC, of Foreign Affairs, felt that he was a member of a terrorist group. I couldn't receive him on the Hill. So I had said, well, I'll receive him then at a hotel on the Hilton and invite some of the church leaders and others to come and greet him. And Bill Weingart and Dave McDonald and a few others from the Parliament. And But that was an illustration then, coming very straight home, that the battle inside the department. Then I was moved to continued with women, and again led the Canadian delegation as a man to the mid decade.
1985, Nairobi.
In Nairobi, were you there? Yeah. So that at first got a lot of things, but we made a good speech, and by the end of it, people were giving us some applause instead of booing. And the women's, and you remember the NGO section of the women and so on, there was a whole element on apartheid. The other thing while there was I had was there with a delegation and a government plane, and I was asked to go to meet Mugabe and Kaunda, the frontline states, in preparation for a Mulroney visit, which was about 18 months later as events came. But went to meet them, talk with them about his particular interest on the issue, and then I became immigration minister. That period was preoccupied for a year plus with Central American refugees and the Reagan administration pushing them back. And I managed to get an accommodation that they could, from El Salvador and so on, they could come to Canada. If they could get through, we would receive them. So on immigration and phony ones from Portugal and others, that year didn't have a lot directly, except on the women's portfolio, which I had, which kept the issue of global women's issues.
When you were in Nairobi, did you meet with the ANC Women's League or any of the South African women in exile in 1985?
I think so. Or I went to the rallies that they had. So I was there. The meetings went for 2.5 weeks. In the middle of it, I made the side trips to try and go and organize for the prime minister and make contact with the frontline states, which through the years proved very helpful because it was an introduction there as a minister and later when I was at the UN and I was there often. So it augured well.
So let's go back. Let's start now with your, if this works in terms of the chronology, your missions at the UN, your assignment at the UN.
So obviously sooner than I would have liked. And I guess in reflection, partly the polls for Moroni as he was getting to 2.5 years into his mandate were down. And he was looking to boost in Quebec, as he said, and to get women into the cabinet. So he said, thank you, I hope I can have your continuing support. So I was then looking and thinking, I didn't come here just for the experience of continuing, although I quite welcome representing the Waterloo riding, which in itself has been an exciting and challenging place. But what would I do? And really, before I had explored anything, I met with Hugh Segal, who was principal secretary. He was the chief of staff to Mulroney as prime minister, who said, Walter, would you be prepared to go to the UN and work with Stephen Lewis? And we have you there as the parliamentary delegate to the General Assembly, number two to Lewis, who leads the delegation.
At that time, Stephen was the...
was ambassador. He was there from 85. He was already on seat. He and I knew each other from CUSO days. He was in Nigeria at one stage, and we had known each other in student politics at the University of Toronto. He was active in the old CCF while I was doing student politics, not really the partisan parties, but he was there. And anyway, we knew each other and liked each other, and so he said, would you go there? And we'd like you to take on this role of African and Commonwealth government's representative on these and do some. So I agreed to do that. It meant that I kept my seat in Parliament. We didn't need an election. Government had won fairly well. I had sympathy at home, in the sense of the people were, as I've mentioned earlier, the makeup of Waterloo Region was global and unlike a lot of places, very much aware of international and human rights and multicultural issues. So I was very fortunate to have, I guess I wouldn't have been there if I hadn't had it. So I went there and what I was really... If they'd had air miles, I would have been doing wonders because I was between 2 or 3 days a week in New York, a couple of days in Ottawa, if not every week, every other week, and also home in the riding on the weekends with the family. And the expectation is that you're not from the West where you go and stay for the period. You commuted back and forth. So that was a unique opportunity. I continued on the Foreign Affairs Committee at home and chaired a subcommittee looking at Africa.
What specifically were you doing around South Africa?
Well, then we were looking and thinking ahead post the apartheid. What structure should the Canadian government have in place, and how should the government facilitate a focus on Africa, given all of the connections of Commonwealth, Francophonie, and so on? And we had Christine, oh boy, it was who became a Liberal Minister of International Development. Christine was my vice chair, and we had a very good committee, worked hard on it, did some research. So we fitted that in around the UN work. Now, the UN work, part of what was happening at home in that period on the anti-apartheid movement was a big pushback on the sanctions. Many of the conservative members of parliament, including some who were really quite good leaders on human rights issues, including John Crosby, to my surprise, because when I was minister, he was justice and I was dealing with women's issues, he was very supportive. His wife Jane prompting him on, but nonetheless, he was very supportive. So when I look back, if I had stayed in Parliament, I would have been again voting against a lot of things that were being brought up because the tensions were high. Tensions on sanctions, tensions with the Americans, and Reagan and Mulroney had good relationships with both Thatcher and he, but maintained them despite his leadership on the apartheid issue.
And what about G7?
Well, the G7 was the same, his work there. So the question where they come together is at the UN. So part of it was we'll deal with the caucus. And we started having, if every other week through the fall period, parliamentary delegations to the UN, usually six. Three conservatives, two liberal, one NDP. And I was in charge of working with the staff at the UN so that we give them a week of orientation on the UN, what was happening in the committees and what were the debates, and introduce them to other parliamentarians who were there as well, looking at issues, and particularly African ones who were very much on the apartheid issue. It also gave me the opportunity, along and with Stephen's high profile and his very articulate part, to work with him. So I did a number of the speeches. He was traveling or others, but between the two of us on African issues into the General Assembly or the committees. And that provided an opportunity when other foreign ministers or ministers came to the UN to talk with them and meet them and talk about where the government was going. And the staff at the UN were empathetic to the leadership of Stephen. But he right off the bat told me of meeting a lot of resistance at headquarters. And that's
in Ottawa.
In Ottawa. A lot of that is reflected in Linda's book. The tension within the department, and that tension playing out in the pressures on Joe Clark as foreign minister, and the question of that. Now, Mulroney came out of that milieu, and it wasn't particularly easy for him, but one part of all of this job that it really was an experience was that we could go to major African meetings, the Economic Commission in Addis, to the African Development Bank. I led the delegation for 7 years to the Donors Conference at SADC, the Southern Africa Development, the frontline states, where the ministers from the donors but also the ministers of the 12 states were there. And we were able to talk about our commitment and in funding some of these organizations, direct some money there. And I had support both politically in the minister's office, in Clark's office, through Roy Norton and others, and the deputy minister, whose name I... who kept threatening to send me to the Congo, but I managed to avoid that. But anyway, he being a Francophone, we were able to work looking at both the Francophone and the Commonwealth as vehicles for the propagation of anti-apartheid views. And
during that time, and when you're going to SADC and you're mm-hmm. going to the region, what was your interaction, if any, with the ANC and the liberation movements?
That's a very important part. At this point, the ANC and SWAPO, Southern African People's Organization in Namibia, had been recognized as to participate in the UN, and they had observer status, and they were there. So I worked along with Thabo Mbeki, with whom I became quite good friends, though he was there for a long time, and Sama Nyoma, who was there. And then the other part of the UN operation was the support of through the UN agencies, of exiles. So, for example, I was able to be in Lusaka a number of times, where the Namibian Institute, now it was funded by the UN, but with Canadian contributions significant, and Hage Geingob was the director of it, who's the current president of Namibia. So my associations go back with him there. Others in Angola, when I was there, the Namibians were there. And there the numbers of these kind of meetings provided an opportunity wherever you went to see their representatives. So the ANC representatives in Canada, and latterly, before the Namibian independence in 1989, I developed a great friendship with Toivo Ya Toivo, who had been at Robben Island with Mandela, who was in Canada, he, for nearly 6 or 8 weeks, used my office to talk and interpret what was going on in the pre-election period. The Namibian experience and the UN experience allowed us, in the Namibian experience earlier than South Africa, was to get some legal expertise in the constitution drafting of those in exile. Secondly, we had there, and it flies under the radar, we had 1,000 troops there in the year 1989, the year of the return of the exiles and the putting of the South African troops into the barracks. I was there, for example, in the town of Sumeb and Groepfontein when they were when the South African troops went in, and the Polish, Canadian, and Nigerian troops were
was
part.
Was UNTAG?
UNTAG. And Matty Atasari was there. I was liaised with him. I brought the first election boxes symbolically from Canada, and we had a relationship or developed relationships between Elections Canada and the holding of that election. And then we had not only 500 troops in a rotation. We had an observer mission through this period. We had 50 RCMP and other police in a policing unit to assist. And we had, for the election, 50, led by Dick Hadfield, the former premier of New Brunswick, election observers.
And in fact, that's where we met, Namibia.
Namibian Independence. And through all of these kinds of association, at another period, I took a parliamentary delegation of six parliamentarians to Namibia before the election so that they, from all parties, so that they could, and we issued a report back to the government on, and traveled and saw what was happening. So the role of contact group and the implementation of the UN Resolution 435 has mixed reviews as to how effective it was, except Canada's part on it in the latter stages, the fact that we had been on it, stuck with it when others opted out, they were all really the G7 members who were part of it were quite indifferent as they were.
Would you see that the experience of the work that Canada did in Namibia as a sort of precursor or model to Canada's role with South Africa?
I think that a lot of the lessons were learned there about the constitutional development. I was in two or three times in South Africa to the Trade Center where the negotiations were going on. And we had numbers of Erwin Kotler and others, legal people from McGill and other centers who were there helping or shaping the Constitution. And that formative discussion, and I think on the south, so Namibian independence came. And we had the election observers, and then we were there for the installation. Interestingly enough, as we record this, my friend David Gallagher is here. But on the night after independence, and I had that was an interesting in itself, the banquet. On the I was there with Toivo Yatoivo, who had been assigned to Canada and who was the great Namibian SWAPO leader. I was sitting at the table, VIP table for heads of government, and at first of all asking him, Toivo, we're in Winto, tell me about this place we're in. He looked at me and said, Walter, I've never been here. This is in the white area. So we were having the banquet, and in comes de Klerk, and with him Nelson Mandela to join us at the table. The whole place erupts for that banquet. Anyway, after this, and we had the events, and Stephen Lewis was there, and you were there, and others in that great celebration. I get a call from David Gallagher. I need you at the border. I fly up to the Angolan border, and he has assembled with Care Canada, World Vision, I think, or Canadian Aviation Fellowship, the flight, and Oxfam, 12 massive lorries for the famine-stricken areas where they had had this smashing the great Battle of Kavuto, where Cubans and the others had smashed the South Africans and driven them back. Enough body bags were going back that they began to, the pressure of sanctions plus the pressure of deaths of young people. In any event, Gallagher had assembled these with Oxfam's leadership and they sat at the border and nobody hit them through. So on the morning after, within days, they've sat there for a number of days. And I flew up and we got in the lead truck and said, well, we're going, this is donations from Canada. And I'm here on behalf of the Canadian government. So we drive up and off we get through the border. And these terrified drivers who had come from Zimbabwe with all this maize. And we drive off and with the Toronto Star reporter and others. And of course,
that was Peter Goodspeed.
Yeah, I think so.
Bill Schiller.
Bill Schiller,
yeah.
Ms. Bill Schiller. And, of course, they report, the night we get there, in God forsaken place, I mean, they say we're going to feed you, the drivers. And they put, some of us up at the front, at a front table. And they bring in food, and they obviously scourged and found enough food to bring it. And, of course, the Toronto Star, here these starving people are, you know, this, you can just see the story of and African hospitality. There was no way you could avoid it. Anyway, we got those massive trucks a day and a half. Then the Mission Aviation Fellowship planes could see the bridges were out. We got somebody else, David got somebody else to bring in small trucks that could ford the rivers, and we offloaded the grain. Then we went on and I think into Lubango, which was a regional chairman, and the governor sent a message saying, I'm delayed in Luanda, but go ahead, you're my guest, and the food's laid on, so invite all. So we invited the medical doctors and the others in for a banquet, Canadians sort of celebrating we got here, crashed our way through the border on behalf of Sam Yoma had sent me. I said, I never really, there was no particular pushback on that day afterwards. But anyway, that was the sidebar of the kind of cooperation of the NGOs who were working in that really mass destruction in Angola.
But now, coming back to your Namibian days, you are the longest-serving honorary consul to Namibia. Mm. So just tell me just quickly how you became honorary consul.
Many countries where they want some representation in different parts of the country will have somebody who, and there's a Geneva protocol for honorary consuls. And there are rules. You can't be paid by the government, but you can consult or you can work. But you can take on responsibilities for them. And from time to time, they may say, hey, we need you to go because we have no staff to go and represent us. So they choose people for either sometimes their commercial interest or their legal or whatever their particular issues. In the state of a small country now, 2.5 million, then when I started in 90, they appointed me when I left Parliament without asking. They were really, I think they were looking for somebody who knew both the political and the national setting in Canada.
So they appointed you in what year?
Appointed me in 1994. Or 93, 94. Teo Ben-Gurion was the foreign minister. I have the letter somewhere. And then, it was very interesting, I received it and I went to Christine Stewart, was the minister, who had been my vice chair on the Committee on the Future in Africa. And I went to her and said, I represented the other party and you're now government. And after the 94 election, I'm not prepared to do this job unless you agree and your government agrees. Because I said, I can't be any help to them if every time I want to speak to the department officials or I want to talk to people in Parliament, they say, no, have nothing to do with him. He's a hated Tory. So she laughed. We had worked unanimously, really, on the committee on African affairs. She came, called me back a few days and did some scouting and said, there will be no problems. And there have never been, on whatever government, any problems since. But it's been that's... So what I do is pro bono, answer the phone, all sorts of questions, one or two a day on visas or how to get on practical questions. But I, in the consular corps, I'm in touch with Toronto. Quebec has a very lively African interest, so does Alberta. And there are consular corps in the larger countries have honorary consuls or sometimes full consuls in those areas. So the honorary consul job is, if you don't have staff, well,
we have 3 minutes left.
Okay. Before independence, part of the things I was discussing when I was in Namibia was with those, how they were going to shape their foreign service, what countries they would have to be in. For political reasons, they had to be in Russia, they had to be in the areas where they had dealt with the Cold War, China and others, Cuba, Angola. Where are you going to be able to be? And obviously they had to be in the United States. But being in Canada, the small budget and the small size of their capacity and what they had to face. So the result was, as fond as they are, and they keep to this day talking of opening a consulate, or particularly with the mining interests, in the Canadian mining interests. So the result is that I do some consulting with my consulting company on corporate social responsibility, and I keep in touch with the government and do any visits they have, try to facilitate them as they have ministers or senior officials come to Canada and see that but there's a rich story of Canadian involvement, which has never been recognized. There has never been a Canadian minister visit Namibia since independence. There was none before in the struggle except myself at ministerial rank. And to this day, there has never been a reception of the president of Namibia in Ottawa or a visit. I asked Kilgore and I asked others, ministers, to go. They're always going to South Africa and said, well, we don't have anything to offer. Because Namibia, because of its mineral resources, wasn't the poorest of the poor. Canadian policy are, we were going to support with CETA aid or development assistance the poorest of the poor. The net result, things have very little changed in the townships. The whole question of education, delivery of health care, delivery of women's programming or of maternal aid is almost unchanged. When I go back, and I was there before independence, and I go into the same communities, just almost, and it's the same in South Africa, my visits there. The reality is that undoing racism is a lifetime, a millennial. Look at the United States on the issue of race 200 years later. 35 or 40 years later, racism is alive and well in South Africa and Namibia, and you get small white pockets saying, what about our minority rights now? As if somehow the whole question of white racial superiority had not, it wasn't at the root of all of this. So the battle goes on. Now the Chinese involvement in the infrastructure, the port of Walvis Bay is virtually owned by the Chinese. The government coming to terms with massive social issues, battling corruption in the Namibian case, which has been very strong under President Geingob, outspoken to try and has maintained high credibility. But the battle for dealing with the townships, the blacks, the coloreds, are still there. And you drive at night and you see the bright white lights, that's the whites. You see it's the middle, that's the colors. And you see very dim lights as you pass through it and come out. Those are all the townships. And the battle goes on to try to undo apartheid. And part of my commitment has been, having spent a lot of my life on this issue, it's been really quite a happy, unplanned, but the contacts and to be able to visualize much of the African continent because of these rich 8 years. So I'm really grateful for that, continuing as health provides to do what I can with the new Canada Africa Chamber of Business to try and broaden it from just mining to get to agriculture, drought and water, education, health care, the things that Canada can provide to Africa, as well as tourism and fisheries on the oceans, on the new chamber, with rather than just Canada South Africa Chamber of Business equals mines, to broaden it. And so that's coming. That's taking some of my energy as well as the Namibian things and the happy interface with the government of my friend Geingob and his senior leaders.
Right, let's do 2 more minutes. We'll talk about Roger Bull and Roy McMurtry. Yeah.
As well as the role that Stephen Lewis played as the Mulroney appointment, the appointments of Roy McMurtry in London And there, it set in over against with the Queen as the head of the Commonwealth, but all of the support for the white apartheid government in South Africa. He was really quite instrumental, or quite a focal point of Mulroney's political appointments. Within the department, because he for example, came in behind the eminent person's recommendations on sanctions. He was a part of the discussions about the Commonwealth when people were talking about it breaking up. He was instrumental in seeing how it could operate. Continue to operate and not break on racial lines. Roger Bull, the High Commissioner in Zimbabwe, but covering, I think, Angola and one or two other countries, he was outspoken, very strong views in support of the anti-apartheid movement. And there was a lot of pushback in the department to him. Eventually, they tried to, he was there 6 years, and as Linda Freeman comments, they tried to bring him home to something and then sidewiled him and put him, I saw him once in Seattle. But he, my visits with him several times, he was really out looking at what needed to be done and the impact of race and so on. So.
This was an interview with the Honorable Walter MacLean, conducted by Susan Bazilli on February 28, 2018 at Carleton University, as part of the Canadian Anti-Apartheid Oral Histories Project.